Well, good afternoon. We're going to be going through our study of Luke, beginning part of Luke chapter 5. We're starting to take our look at some of the first of the inner circle, the 12, the closest disciples of Messiah. So we'll be going through Luke chapter 5 and parallel passages that are in Matthew chapter 4, Mark chapter 1, and John chapter 1.
Luke 5, 1 through 11. So it was, as the multitude pressed about him to hear the word of God, that he stood by the lake of Gennesaret, and saw two boats standing by the lake, but the fishermen had gone from them and were washing their nets. Then he got into one of the boats, which was Simon's, and asked him to put out a little from the land. And he sat down and taught the multitudes from the boat. When he had stopped speaking, he said to Simon, "Launch out into the deep and let down your nets for a catch." But Simon answered and said to him, "Master, we have toiled all night and caught nothing. Nevertheless, at your word, I will let down the net." And when they had done this, they caught a great number of fish, and their net was breaking. So they signaled to their other partners in the other boat to come and help them. And they came and filled both the boats, so that they began to sink. When Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees, saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." For he and all who were with him were astonished at the catch of fish which they had taken. And so also were James and John, the sons of Zebedee, who were partners with Simon. And Jesus said to Simon, "Do not be afraid. From now on, you will catch men." So when they had brought their boats to land, they forsook all and followed him. Matthew 4, 18 through 22. And Jesus, walking by the Sea of Galilee, saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and Andrew his brother, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. Then he said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you fishers of men." They immediately left their nets and followed him. Going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, in the boat with Zebedee, their father, mending their nets. He called them, and immediately they left the boat and their father and followed him. Mark chapter 1, verses 16 through 20. And as he walked by the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew his brother casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. Then Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men." They immediately left their nets and followed him. When he had gone a little farther from there, he saw James the son of Zebedee and John his brother, who also were in the boat mending their nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and went after him. And John chapter 1, verses 35 through 51. Again the next day, John stood with two of his disciples, and looking at Jesus as he walked, he said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." The two disciples heard him speak, and they followed Jesus. Then Jesus turned, and seeing them following, said to them, "What do you seek?" They said to him, "Rabbi," which is to say, when translated, "teacher." "Where are you staying?" He said to them, "Come and see." They came and saw where he was staying, and remained with him that day. Now it was about the 10th hour. One of the two who heard John speak and followed him was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first found his own brother Simon and said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which is translated the Christ. And he brought him to Jesus. Now when Jesus looked at him, he said, "You are Simon the son of Jonah. You shall be called Cephas," which is translated a stone. The following day Jesus wanted to go to Galilee, and he found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses in the law and also the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." And Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." Jesus saw Nathanael coming toward him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom is no deceit." Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" Jesus answered and said to him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered and said to him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered and said to him, "Because I said to you, I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Most assuredly, I say to you, hereafter you shall see heaven open, and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man."
Are there any comments or observations before we get started with the rest of this? Anything you observed?
Yes. I just saw a parallel between him and Jacob.
Oh, yeah?
Ascending, descending, ascending, descending.
Yes.
Direct parallel.
Yeah. Quite right. As we were noting, you see a lot of these allusions to the prophets and such, and that's another one of those great pictures, a prophecy in and of itself, that is picked up again as well. Any other observations? Well, one of the first things that we take a look at here is you'll note in these accounts that a couple of them are quite similar, almost identical, between Matthew and Mark. Very close wording between them, and you'll notice that Luke and John, those accounts, are different. And it's quite interesting about the differences. Starting off first, noting the order of things. As we've come through looking at the parallel passages between them, we will see that in Luke 4 and 5, the order of events, especially of the calling of these first of the 12, is a bit of a different order than you see there in Mark. And for example, Mark's account, and Matthew kind of follows that same approach there in chapter 4 of Matthew, but Mark chapter 1, you know, starts out with that preaching in the Galilee region, then the calling of these the fishermen who are the first of the 12, then you have the teaching on Shabbat, then the exorcism in the synagogue, then the healing of Peter's mother-in-law, then the healing on Shabbat in Capernaum. Versus Luke, as we've seen in the past couple of chapters, starts out with the preaching in Capernaum, more specific than just the region of Galilee. Then the teaching of Shabbat, the exorcism, the healing of the mother-in-law, then the healing after Shabbat in Capernaum, and then the calling of the fishermen. So you've got that starting in Mark's version with the calling being first, and then in Luke, the calling being near the end of the account or leading up to it. So you've got an account where in Luke the focus is kind of leading up to the things that happened beforehand. Because when you, especially in this passage that we just saw here in Matthew and Mark, you've got these accounts of the calling of these groups of first disciples, and it just seems like he said, "Oh, follow me," and bam, they just left everything and went with them. Versus in Luke and John, you see that there was a bit of a backstory there and more of an interaction between Messiah and these people that was really made a big impression. And one of those things that you notice from Luke's account is that Luke's account really focuses on Peter. And especially, you'll see that right from the beginning, that when he goes down and they got the crowds pressing on him when he's against the lake, and then he goes out into the water in a boat, And it talks specifically, he picked Simon's boat to go out there. And as you get from these accounts, there that these, you know, Simon and Andrew and James and John, they seem to be partners with the father of James and John in this fishing enterprise. So he's got that picking out of the boat that Simon's on specifically. And then you've got this complaining that Shimon is bringing out first. This complaining that they've been out all night, and then Yeshua tells them to go back out again and put their nets down off a specific side of the boat, not just any side. Now, many people over the many years have come up with various observations about this. But one of the things I thought was quite interesting, that a lesson that comes from this, is that in Yeshua is the power of God coming through. This is not just a teacher, but the power of God into the very line of work that you actually do. In Shimon's case, it was affecting fishing. When you think of your own line of work, that if God were to work some fantastic sign out of there in your own business, I mean, I would just love it if, you know, suddenly God was to work a sign and suddenly the newspaper would come out with stories with my name on it that I didn't even write. Now, that would be lovely. I said, that would be fantastic. Or in your case, David, you know, having the kitchen being done without your having anything to do with it. Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? But it definitely would get your attention because it's working now into, you know, God is real in your life, in your specific focus in life. It also comes down to a second lesson regarding the net, is that being a very important part of the business that they were in was the net. And we get a parable over in Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13, among three of these kingdom parables, the kingdom of heaven is like. And one of those, starting in verse 51 of Matthew chapter 13, we get this vision of the net. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a dragnet cast into the sea, and the gathering of fish of every kind. And it was filled. They drew it up on the beach, and they sat down and gathered the fish into containers. But the bad ones they threw away. So it will be at the end of the age. The angels will come forth to take out the wicked from the righteous, and will throw them into the furnace of fire. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Have you understood all these things? They said to him, yes. And Jesus said to them, therefore, every scribe who has become a disciple of the kingdom of heaven is like a head of a household who brings out his treasure, things new and old. Which we'll get to at the end of Luke chapter 5 in some of the parallel passages that show up there. This idea of new wineskins and old wineskins and such. This picture keeps coming up again and again. But the idea of this particular parable is of the net, and it's catching everything. I remember in some of the times of commercial fishing, it's we didn't use nets. We used long lines with lots and lots of hooks on them. And it was really like a kind of a surprise every time the next hook would come up, what would be on it. I mean, sometimes it'd be a fish, sometimes it'd only be the fish head, and the crabs got the rest of it. And then sometimes it'd be like, I think the most fun we had was the octopus that came up on one of them. It was on the fish that was on there originally. And so we got this little tiny octopus. It was a cute little thing. And it got up on the deck, and then we're trying to figure out what to do with this thing. And we grabbed it, and we're trying to put it into the bait bucket, because they weren't wanting to use it for bait. But it threw all its arms all over the side of the trash can, and they are strong. Wow, they are strong. And we're trying to fight this thing to get it in there, and finally it took off, And, you know, I think they move fast in the water. Well, this thing was scooting along the deck of the boat. But anyway, you just never know what you're going to get on those things. And sometimes when you talk about the good fish and the bad fish, the good fish, you know, we were fishing for halibut in that case. So it was great when you look down in the water and you see a big halibut coming up. But the bad fish, they had this, in Alaska, they had this thing, I call it the English Lord. It was probably some Irishman who came up with that one. But the ugliest looking fish ever. It had like spines on it. All of its fins and flippers had just these spikes on it. And it usually had worms all over it. It was horrible. A horrible fish. So that certainly went into the bad pile. But this is a great picture of the kingdom of heaven, and there's other parables like that. It's like, you know, the wheat and the tares and such like that, is that all these types of people are going to come into the kingdom of God. The task of the servants was to throw the net and to keep mending the net and to keep dragging the net. That was the job, was to get it out there. So one of those great lessons is that God is the one who's going to fill the net. He's going to fill the net. So in Peter's case, he was lamenting about the fact that they'd been out all night and hadn't caught a thing. Hadn't caught anything. And now you had this great sign right in his line of work. Bam! All these fish. This great number of fish. That really caught their attention. But one of the other things that I was thinking as I was looking at this, is also that in proclaiming the kingdom of God, that sometimes the fishless times, you know, people often say fruitless, but in this case it's fishless times, can really stretch you. Or what are you going to do? Are you going to say, well, I've been working so hard, doing your work, and nothing's come of it, and so that's it. God is not with me, he's not doing anything, or are we just going to go out that last time and follow that direction where God is pointing us in, to cast the net in a certain direction he wants to go, and maybe in a direction that we don't think is going to really bring any, quote, fish, unquote, into the net. So it's really a great picture, because it caught Peter's attention. And you'll see also in this passage that we'll look at, it's really quite similar to this particular passage that we're looking at here. It's at the end of John's account, in John chapter 21. So in John chapter 21, we'll take a look at the first start there and go through verse 14 of John chapter 21. But it's really quite interesting of this. Richard had mentioned earlier, you know, that they had just gotten so disheartened. They said, let's go fishing. So let's go back to what we know. Let's go back to at least something that we know something about. Yeah, go back to where we came from. Kind of a pointless thing. After these things, Jesus manifested himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias, and he manifested himself in this way. Simon Peter and Thomas called Didymus, and Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, and the sons of Zebedee, and two others of his disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, I am going fishing. They said to him, No, we will come also with you. They went out and got into the boat, and that night they caught nothing. But when the day was now breaking, Jesus stood at the beach, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. So Jesus said to them, Children, you do not have any fish, do you? They answered him, No. And he said to them, Cast the net on the right hand side of the boat, and you will find a catch. So they cast, and then they were not able to haul it in because of the great number of fish. That's the same passage that you heard back there in Luke, a great number of fish. Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, It is the Lord. So when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he had been stripped for work, and threw himself into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from land, about 100 yards away, dragging the net full of fish. So when they got out on the land, they saw a charcoal fire already laid and fish placed on it and bread. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish which you have caught." Simon Peter went up and drew the net to land full of large fish, 153. And although there were so many, the net was not torn. Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples ventured to question him, "Who are you?" knowing that it was the Lord. Jesus came and took the bread and gave it to them, and the fish likewise. This is now the third time that Jesus was manifested to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. And some people have made the observation down through time of connections using the number 153 and connections to the values of Hebrew letters and such and what that might mean. However, one thing not to miss is that what goes on in this chapter, in this discussion of verses 15 down through 17, in this back and forth between Peter and Yeshua, back and forth about, you know, do you love me? And there you get this, that's one of those variations that we lose in English. We lose that in English because it's using one word, and we use one word, love, and in the, at least in the Greek form of it, the Greek had at least three, a few more, but three main ones that used for love, you know, the agape and phileo, meaning agape we know is a more of the unselfish, selfless love. Charity, I think, from the KJV is probably one of the best ways to translate agape. It gets closer to kind of that selflessness of agape. But then phileo is, you know, more like a friendship, fellowship, and then eros is more of a romantic, erotic thing. But, yeah, it can definitely lend you into error very quickly. So it's one of those things that agape is a better way to approach life. But it's really quite interesting here that following these three times that Yeshua keeps asking Peter, do you agape me? Do you have the selfless devotion? And each one of these times, it's connecting that after Peter says, well, you know, after he asks him, do you agape me? Yes, I phileo you. Do you agape me? Yes, I phileo you. Do you love me unwaveringly, unselfishly? Yes, I love you as a brother or as a great teacher or someone familiar. And he kept ending that statement with, tend my lambs. Shepherd my sheep. Tend my sheep. Kept tagging that on to the end of that response by Peter. Now, this is quite an interesting thing because this lesson, recall what we just were reading there in Luke of this account back there with the great number of fish that they hauled in, and that made a huge impression on these fishermen of who they were dealing with. This is not just another great rabbi to come along. This is someone who's got the power of God working in his life. Now, this is a great lesson in here that Peter, which in John's account it talks about there in verse 42, that when Andrew brought Simon to the Messiah, Yeshua looked at him and said, "You are Shimon, the son of Yohanan. You shall be called Cephas," which is translated Peter, or Petros versus Petra. So you got this idea of a little stone. And in a sense, I guess he's a chip off the cornerstone. So the cornerstone being the rock, and Petros, Peter, being the chip off of that. So just as the Messiah was, and we see in that prayer in John 15 and such, of that incredible care and praying of Yeshua to the Father to guard and protect these ones, that none of them would be lost. That this was something also that Peter, he thought it was going back to the old way of life, it was all hopeless and of no avail. Yet Yeshua was coming to him and saying, look, you know that lesson about the net? Well, it's not just about dragging stuff in. It's about proper, to extend the metaphor even further, proper handling of the fish once you get them into the net. It's one of those great things that a lot of people don't realize when you go salmon fishing, is that salmon rot very quickly after they're dead. Rot extremely quickly. So when you get the salmon, you've got to cut the head, cut the tail off almost immediately and drain them out, because that great redness of the meat of a salmon, well, it will get rotten if you just leave the head on, and it ends up being not worth much for dog food if you leave it on for too long. So when you want the proper care, if you really care for what you're doing and what you get, is you have to prepare it on site. And a lot of the big ships, like the large fishing ships, and you might have watched the Most Dangerous Catch or something like that. They got the hold there, and that's usually refrigerated, and they dump the fish into it so that when they get to the tender boat, where they are doing the cleaning of the fish and such, that it's happening extremely quickly. I mean, if you want to get like the fresh fish everyone loves, you got to clean the fish within a few hours at most. So taking this back into this thing of a net and what you get in the net, and you got good fish, you got bad fish. Well, one of the things that you see in the other parables is to not be so hasty. Not be so hasty in what you think are good fish and bad fish. Because that's not so obvious. In the parable of the wheat and the tares, it's like, yeah, do you want us to go in there and pull out the weeds? Well, if you do that, you might rip up some of the wheat too. So not a really good thing to do. And you might mistake one for another. So, not a great thing to do. However, in fishing, you have to treat the fish well and care for them. So, taking that extension further, is you get this picture of tending and shepherding. Those are like two things. He says like feeding and shepherding. Those are like two roles in there. To feed the lambs, make sure that they've got what they need. Shepherd the lambs. You might remember in the accounts of David that one of the roles of a shepherd is to protect the flock from wolves or bears or lions or whatever. Oh my, you have whatever you have that's attacking the flock, you have to protect against that. And that gets into a lot of one of those writings in Paul, where they call like some of the pastoral epistles, of this protecting of those who are weaker in faith. Maybe they've got wrong ideas of who God is and such. And to really be careful in how you deal with those people. So it's one of those great lessons that it's like, Peter, you're now going into a new role. You all are now fishermen in a different sort. Which kind of goes back to another great application that really caught me from this, is that just as it mentions in Ecclesiastes that whatever you do it as if you're working for the Lord. So in a sense, it's like Peter, the same care and the same diligence, out there working all night, just toiling away. I read that and I think of the commercial fishing openings. This is government regulation, but still they give you just maybe 72 hours and you just go out there and that's it. Once the 72 hours are up, out comes the warden if you're not back in port. But that idea that you have just a short amount of time and you just got to go at it and you just like when those commercial fishing things are open, a lot of those people might work for all 72 hours straight, not sleeping, because you just got to get as much as you can in that short amount of time. So it's like, Peter, you know, if you're wanting to really take your dedication, your devotion, your energy, your drive, now take it to the dragnet, the real dragnet that really matters and that really is going to last. Because, you know, you may get your food, but the fish will rot, the fish will get sold. You'll have to go out and get more fish tomorrow or something like that. But this is something that's lasting. Something that's lasting, because when you see that down in the great revelations that are given to Yohanan of the foundation stones of the great city, those gates named after the great apostles. So built tribes, built apostles, these great 12 that were sent out to be great fishermen, and we follow in the example of it. Now, one of the interesting things of back in Matthew 13 with this parable of the dragnet is these are all about the kingdom of heaven. Great, the kingdom of heaven is like a dragnet. What does that mean? The kingdom of heaven is like a dragnet. Okay, we just talked about the fact that it's going to catch people, but what does that mean?
All, but only few are chosen.
Calls all, but only few are chosen. How does he call? I mean, how does he call? When he's talking about, Peter, go out and get the net out. Well, what does that mean? Cast what out? Words. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. People keep thinking about future, this and that and the other. When Yohanan, the baptizer, came through, bringing the kingdom of heaven, what was Yohanan bringing? Repent, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Hello, Isaiah 40. Yeah, that was, I really meant that. I wasn't just, you know, just bloviating through Isaiah. All that stuff is really going to happen, and it's happening now. And all that stuff. Isaiah 53? Yeah, I meant that. That's going to happen. Pay attention. So, these words are not just lots and lots and lots of words. These words are God's testimony. God's throwing the net out into the world. And one of the great lessons of Peter is that God's going to fill that net.
It doesn't break.
It doesn't break. Wow. That's nice, because, boy, we lost lots of hooks. Because those... It doesn't matter how high of a tension line you've got on those hooks. They still break. They still break. And then you've got those pesky people that pull up your lines and make off with them. Yeah, that's not fun. But it's one of those great things is that what is being cast out, this great net, the kingdom of God? How does anyone know about it? How does anyone know about what this kingdom of heaven is? God has testified in His Word what it is. Who He is. Who the Messiah is. So you don't need a guru. You don't need an oracle. You don't need a big flashing light unless you're headed in the wrong direction and you need to get turned around. But that's a pretty rough awakening that Paul figured out. But God has given us in His Word this great net. And just like Peter had to realize, hey, that net needs to get thrown out. That's something else for us to realize that we need to be casting the net out as well.
When God throws His net out, He brings it in, but then He has to sort out which is good, which is not good.
Yes.
And He throws away that which is not good.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, when the things like on the tender ships, the fishermen on the boat, you know, they've got their little ruler and such that they use on the fish to see which are big enough to keep at that point, which they have to throw back immediately. Otherwise, the warden comes after them. Because you don't want the small ones to showing up at the factory boat, because at that time they're dead and then the warden gets mad, and then you get a fine. So you want to catch those actually in the boat and get them thrown over the side. So it's one of those great points that when people are coming in to God's net, to not just be so hasty, because what we think is good and what we think is bad, maybe just the opposite. So that's one of those great lessons that even Paul had to figure out. And you see that in Romans chapter 11. He had to be just perplexed at why it was that none of his brothers were getting it, even though they had all the testimony of all the same prophets that he was shown. I mean, he had to have the blinding light and then have someone teach him. He had to have the Messiah really turn him around and teach him, look, all this stuff that you filled your head with, okay, there's the good, and then there was the not so good. One of those great things that God works with all of us on. So, as we go into the rest of this chapter, just kind of look at this first calling of these firstborns. We're going to see some more at the end of chapter 5, some more that he calls. But when you see them, look at who these people are. Now, for example, we're going to close on with the calling of Nathanael. And the calling of Nathanael here, like in John chapter 1, starting, you know, like in verse 47. Now, Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said of him, "Behold, an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Another way to say that, in there is no darkness. There's no shadows, is another way that could be rendered. Nathanael said to him, "Well, how do you know me?" And Jesus answered and said to him, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Wow, that's a pretty amazing quick turn of events. For Peter, it was seeing a big net full of fish after he had had a completely pointless night of fishing. For Nathanael, it was that God was watching him. You know, some people down through time, some of the church fathers have had this idea that what Nathanael was doing under the fig tree was praying under a fig tree. Now, imagine that. Imagine having God say to you, "Look, I saw you pray." You know, sometimes when you're praying, you don't think it's going anywhere. Can you imagine having God actually say to you, "Look, yeah, I saw you praying, I heard you." I mean, saying to you personally. Now, when you talk about faith, I had this discussion earlier today with people when we were talking about Joshua. And Joshua, as he was getting ready to enter into the land. And he kept having this, you know, God had to keep saying to him, he had to command him, "Be courageous." And then finally come in later with the commander of the Lord's army and say, "Hey, look, this is your task. Be courageous." In a sense, you know, to use a spiritual phrase that people often throw around today, have faith. Well, faith is trust. It means the same in Hebrew as it does in Greek. Trust. Depend. Depend upon it. So when God says, "Look, I'm going to send you into the land over there," and if you read that in Joshua chapter 1, he says, you're going to take over the land of the Hittites. Now, that might just kind of roll off as a vague reference that someone maybe thought about some time ago, but we now know who the Hittites are. And they are what the Bible said they were. An empire. So you're talking about people who had just come out of Egypt, barely organized. God had kind of whipped them into shape over a couple of year period. Now they're going to head into the land. And God's telling them, "You're going to go up and you're going to take over part of the Hittite empire." Yeah, for sure. Okay. But that kind of trust to say that when God tells you he's going to do something, and he's going to give you the power, that depend upon that. That is reality. So like for Peter, it was seeing the fish in the net, lots and lots of fish, at the word of Yeshua saying, look, go out there, put the net down, you're going to get something. And boom, he got something. For Nathaniel, it was just as simple as like, I saw you. I saw you under the tree. You know, and for Joshua, it was like, I'm going to send you into that land and it's yours. It is yours. Don't worry about it. So when we talk about courage and trust and faith, this is not some sort of strange, far off, you know, metaphysical thing. It's in the here and now. This is reality that you're talking about here. It's reality because if you really do believe that God is the creator and that God is the master, then that means that your everyday life, this is real. And when God is saying and giving his testimony in time, whether it be the accounts to the patriarchs and prophets and then to the apostles and such, these are things that happen in time. They're real. And it might take a little bit of a strange jog of thought. But, you know, we pick up the paper and people will hear about so-and-so, you know, out on Highway 101, hit a tree. Now, being a journalist, I could say this, you know, you might doubt that actually happened or not, but usually when you read the paper and it says something like that, you don't doubt that that's actually happened. And when God is giving his testimony down through time in this, then when he says things, they actually happened. And as Yohanan had to remind the people of the coming of Messiah, that yeah, what the prophets said, that is going to happen. They said that then, and it is going to happen. And he said the kingdom of heaven is at hand, it's here now. So when you get down further and Paul starts talking about, you know, Christ in you, that is reality. It's not never, never land. This is reality. This is stating a fact. And that's what, I guess, when you look at the calling of each one of these disciples, you might wonder, like in Matthew and Mark's accounts, it just seemed like, oh, they just dropped everything and followed him. But what was it where God grabbed them? God grabbed them where they were and said, look, you've been taught all this stuff since you were, you know, a little kid, you bar mitzvah and such, and you heard all that. Well, guess what? It's real. I mean, have you ever stopped to think about that? When you read stuff like Revelation, that's talking about reality. Wow. Blows your mind. You think, oh, that's got to be some other place, some other time, and that kind of thing. You're talking reality here. And in this world, I have this discussion also in the same context of Joshua, of, yeah, there's the world of, you know, the things that happen, the engineering of the world and such like that, the stuff that makes iPhones possible and TVs and cars and all that stuff. And then there's religion over here. Okay. Well, why even bother with the religion thing if it's not talking about reality? I mean, I've got better things to do. I can play with my iPhone a lot more. But if what you're talking about here in religion is reality, you're dumb to ignore it. Or, in some cases, veiled. Which is what we'll be getting to in further discussions of some of the apostles. And, you know, you might say, how dumb could they possibly be? Well, we saw examples of Israel in the Exodus and all their trials and rebellions and stuff like that. How dumb could they possibly be? And then Richard was just talking about Judas. You know, how dumb could he possibly be? Well, human, fallen, frail, yet God is glorified in that. Because God is presenting to us that, yeah, I understand, you know, that you did something really dumb. Adam did something really dumb. and then we've been living with it ever since. But there is a different reality out there. You don't have to live like this anymore. And I'm not just going to cast you off because your life does not correspond to what the pattern I've showed is the right way to live. I'm actually going to take you to the place where you should be, and probably in many cases you want to be. You know, like in the discussions there in Romans, the good that I want to do, I don't do. You may come to the point where you say, yeah, that's exactly what I want to be. I want to be a man of God. I want to be a woman of God. Yet, you know, lust of the eyes, pride of life, lust of the flesh, and you get dragged away and enticed. However, God shows His glory over any other deity or any other philosophy or ology or ism or whatever, in that even during betrayal, He has mercy. Even not just one betrayal, thousands of years of betrayal. That is amazing. We talk about long suffering. Wow, I don't think Moshe even caught the half of what that meant at that time period, because there was going to be, you know, a couple, 3,000 years later, there would still be a lot of rebellion and such. So when you come through and we go through these accounts again, you probably have read these a bazillion times since we were young, but take a look at from the standpoint of what Yohanan was saying, what Yeshua is saying. The kingdom of heaven is at hand. It is here now. Well, what does that mean? You know, if you were to be driving down the road and the kingdom of heaven, boom, that would catch your attention. Well, God keeps saying, look, what do I have to do to get it more clear to you that this is reality? So, it's been several thousand years of trying to get back to that reality and that realization. Are there any last comments or questions or such?
I was just thinking about Nathanael's response, saying, you are the Son of God and you are the King of Israel. And if we read a lot of Jewish literature, there's a lot of stories and I don't know if it's legends or real stories about miraculous encounter of God and miracles played by rabbis and famous sages and people running to Elijah and how Elijah guide them and do things for them. And Nathanael came just the first encounter, and he can say the King of Israel. And the Son of God is a not very traditional Jewish concept. Because Son of God may be Son of David, but Son of God is quite rare. So I'm just wondering, if without God's power, how can Nathanael just recognize Christ as the Messiah right away?
Yeah, and it may be in that personal connection. I mean, if it indeed is the case that Nathanael was in the midst of prayer when Messiah saw him, that makes a big impact. Because if he's praying to God and Messiah is saying, look, you know, I saw you. Wow, that's got to be an impact. Well, who else was he talking to at that time period? Who else? You know, when you see the account of when in Daniel, when he has, Gabriel comes and shows up and is like, yeah, you know, I got the message to come here right when you started praying. Talk about, wow, about speedy delivery. That you can have, you know, one of the big two or four show up at your doorstep. God heard what you were saying. So it kind of breaks into reality again. To the point where you say those great time periods, it's really quite interesting when you see this thing show up throughout the writings and the prophets there about these people, and in the Torah itself, these people that are put in positions, you know, not the firstborn, but the second or last born, the continual prime ministership of major empires, being held by God's people. You know, Joseph in Egypt, Daniel, Mordecai. That's a good one. So we got Egypt, Babylon, and Persia. Wow. That's pretty exciting. And then, you know, when you start thinking about the implications of Uriah, you know, when we start realizing that the Hittite Empire was nothing to sneeze at, and that at the time of David, the Davidic Empire was expanding up towards the Euphrates, which is quite interesting, because when talking to Joshua, when he was going to expand up to the Euphrates, well, that's also where the Hittite Empire was. Interesting. But it's really quite interesting how you have God placed there right next to these great world powers. And it really is quite interesting also, and you know, lesson when you talk about Peter working with throwing the net and letting God take care of the details, such as what comes into the net. When you think of Daniel and Joseph and Mordecai, who they served under, you know, you hear accounts of who those people were, Xerxes and Nebuchadnezzar and Darius and, you know, whoever that Pharaoh was that Joseph served with. You know, we know down through time, at least the other folks in Babylon and Persia were, there were no pussycats. They wiped people out right and left, their own subjects, etc. Not pretty people. So it's one of those things that God works on a long-term plan. He's got a long-term vision for where things are. And like he says at the end of the book of Daniel, look, these things that I told you to write down, just write them down, because they're going to apply a long time after you're gone. But just trust that I've got it all in hand. So when you talk about trust and courage and such, wow, that's a long vision.